The Fifth Trip, or Gibura. Swift Kick, Inc. And behold, thusly was the law formulated. Imposition of order equals escalation of chaos. Lord Omar Khayyam Ravenhurst, The Gospel According to Fred, The Honest Book of Truth. The lights flashed, the computer buzzed. Hagbard attached the electrodes. On January the 30th, 1939, a silly little man in Berlin gave a silly little speech. Among other things he said,
"And another thing I wish to say on this day, which is perhaps most memorable not only for us Germans. In my life, I have been many times a prophet, and most of the times I have been laughed at. During the period of my struggle for power, it was in the first case the Jews that laughed at my prophecies that some day I would take over the leadership of the state and thereby the whole folk, and that I would, among others, solve also the Jewish problem. I believe that in the meantime the hyena-like laughter of the Jews of Germany has been smothered in their throats. Today I want to be a prophet once more. If the international finance Jews inside and outside Europe should succeed once more in plunging nations into another world war, the consequence will be the annihilation of the Jewish race in Europe."
And so on. He was always saying things like that. By 1939, quite a few heads here and there realized that the silly little man was also a murderous little monster. But only a very small number, even of these, noticed that for the first time in his anti-Semitic diatribes, he had used the word Vernichtung, annihilation. And even they couldn't believe he meant what that implied. In fact, outside of a small circle of friends, nobody guessed what the little man, Adolf Hitler, had planned. Outside that small, very small circle of friends, others came in intimate contact with Der Führer and never guessed what was in his mind. Hermann Rauschning, the governor of Danzig, for instance, was a devout Nazi, until he began to get some hints of where Hitler's fancies were tending. After fleeing to France, Rauschning wrote a book warning against his former leader. It was called The Voice of Destruction and was very eloquent, but the most interesting passages in it were not understood by Rauschning or by most of his readers.
"Whoever sees in National Socialism nothing but a political movement doesn't know much about it,"
Hitler told Rauschning, and this is in the book. But Rauschning and his readers continued to see National Socialism as a particularly vile and dangerous political movement, and nothing more.
"Creation is not yet completed,"
Hitler said again, and Rauschning again recorded, without understanding,
"The planet will undergo an upheaval which you, uninitiated people, can't understand."
Der Führer warned on another occasion, and still another time, he remarked that Nazism was not only more than a political movement, but
more than a new religion.
And Rauschning wrote it all and understood none of it. He even recorded the testimony of Hitler's physician that the silly and murderous little man often awoke screaming from nightmares that were truly extraordinary in their intensity and would shout,
"It's him! It's him! He's come for me!"
Good old Hermann Rauschning, a German of the old school and not equipped to participate in the new Germany of National Socialism, took all this as evidence of mental unbalance in Hitler.
"All of them coming back, all of them, Hitler and Stryker and Goebbels and the powers behind them, what looked like something you can't even imagine, Governor. You think they was human?"
The patient went on as the psychiatrist listened in astonishment.
"But wait till you see them the second time, and they're coming. By the end of the month, they're coming."
Karl Haushofer was never tried at Nuremberg. Ask most people to name the men chiefly responsible for the Vernichtung, annihilation decision, and his name will not be mentioned. Even most histories of Nazi Germany relegate him to footnotes. But strange stories are told about his many visits to Tibet, Japan, and other parts of the Orient. His gift for prophecy and clairvoyance. The legend that he belonged to a bizarre sect of dissident and most peculiar Buddhists, who had entrusted him with a mission in the Western world so serious that he vowed to commit suicide if he did not succeed. If the last yarn is true, Haushofer must have failed in his mission, for in March 1946 he killed his wife Martha and then performed the Japanese suicide rite of seppuku upon himself. His son, Albrecht, had already been executed for his role in the officer's plot to assassinate Hitler. Of his father, Albrecht had written in a poem, "My father broke the seal. He did not feel the breath of the evil one. He set it free to roam the world." It was Karl Haushofer, clairvoyant, mystic, medium, orientalist, and fanatic believer in the lost continent of Thule, who introduced Hitler to the Illuminated Lodge in Munich in 1923. Shortly thereafter, Hitler made his first bid to seize power. No rational interpretation of the events of August 1968 in Chicago, satisfactory to all participants and observers, has yet been produced. This suggests the need for value-free models, inspired by the structural analysis in von Neumann and Morgenstern's theory of games and economic behaviour, which will allow us to express what actually occurred functionally, without tainting our analysis with bias or moral judgments. The model we will employ is that of the two teams, an uphill motor car race and a downhill bicycle race, accidentally intersecting on the same hill. The Picasso statue in the Civic Center will be regarded as start for the downhill motor race and finish for the uphill bicycle race. Pontius Pilate, disguised as Sirhan Sirhan, fires the opening shot, thereby disqualifying Robert F. Kennedy, for whom Marilyn Monroe committed suicide, as recorded in the most trustworthy tabloids and scandal sheets.
This is the voice of your friendly neighbourhood Spider-Man speaking. You must realise that you are not Joseph Wendell Malick.
Hell's Angels on motorcycles do not fit the structure of the race at all, so they endlessly orbit around the heroic statue of General Logan in Grant Park. Finish for the uphill crucifixion racers, and can be considered as isolated from the action, which is, of course, America. When Jesus falls the first time, this can be considered as a puncture, and Simon operates an air pump on his tyres. But the threat to throw LSD in the water supply constitutes a foul, and this team thereby is driven back three squares by mace, clubs, and the machine guns of the Capone mob, unleashed from another time track in the same multiverse. Willard Gibbs, far more than Einstein, created the modern cosmos, and his concept of contingent or statistical reality, when cross-fertilized with the second law of thermodynamics by Shannon and Vina, led to the definition of information as the negative reciprocal of probability, making the clubbings of Jesus by Chicago cops just another of those things that happen in this kind of quantum jump. A centurion named Semper Cooney Linctus passes Simon in Grant Park looking for the uphill bike race.
"When we crucify a man,"
he mutters,
"he should confounded well stay crucified."
The three Marys clutch handkerchiefs to their faces as the tear gas and Cyclone B pours upward on the hill,
to the spot where the crosses and the statue of General Logan stand.
Nor dashed a thousand, Kim.
Croon Saint Toad, looking through the door at Fission Chips. Arthur Flagenheimer and Robert Putney Drake ascend the chimney.
You don't have to believe in Santa Claus.
H.P. Lovecraft explains.
Ambrose,
the Dutchman says to him imploringly.
But it can't be,
Joe Malik says, half weeping.
It can't be that crazy. Buildings wouldn't stand, planes wouldn't fly, dams would collapse. Engineering colleges would be lunatic asylums.
They aren't already?
Simon asks.
Have you read the latest data on the ecological catastrophe? You gotta face it, Joe. God is a crazy woman.
There are no straight lines in curved space,
Stella adds.
But my mind is dying,
Joe protests, shuddering. Simon holds up an ear of corn and tells him urgently,
Osiris is a black god.
Sir Charles James Napier, bearded, long-haired and 60-odd years old, General of Her Majesty's Armies in India, met a most engaging scoundrel in January 1843 and immediately wrote to his cronies in England about this remarkable person whom he described as brave, clever, fabulously wealthy and totally unscrupulous. Since this curious fellow was also regarded as God by his followers, who numbered over 3 million, he charged 20 rupees for permission to kiss his hand, asked and got the sexual favours of the wives or daughters of any true believers who took his fancy, and proved his divinity by brazenly and openly committing sins which any mortal would shrill with shame to have acknowledged. He also proved at the Battle of Myani, where he aided the British against the rebellious Baluchi tribesmen, that he could fight like 10 tigers. All in all, General Napier concluded, a most unusual human being. Hassan Ali Shah Mahalat, 46th Imam, or living god, of the Ismailian sect of Islam. Direct descendant of Hassani Sabah and first Aga Khan.
Dear Joe, I'm back in Chicago again, fabulous Demesne of Crooked Back Richard, Pig Bashard of the World, etc., where the pollution comes up like thunder out of Gary across the lake, etc., and the Padre and I are still working on the heads of the local heads, etc., so I finally got time to write to you that long letter I promised. The Law of Fives is all the farther that Weishaupt ever got. And Hagbard and John aren't much interested in any further speculations along those lines. The 2317 phenomenon is entirely my discovery, except that William S. Burroughs has noted the 23 without coming to any conclusions about it. I'm writing this on a bench in Grant Park near the place I got maced 3 years ago. Nice symbolism. A woman just came along from the Mother's March Against Polio. I gave her a quarter. What a drag. Just when I was trying to get my thoughts in order. When you come out here, I'll be able to tell you more. This will obviously have to be somewhat sketchy. Burroughs, anyway, encountered the 23 in Tangiers when a ferry boat captain named Clark remarked that he'd been sailing 23 years without an accident. That day, his ship sunk, with all hands and feet aboard. Burroughs was thinking about it in the evening when the radio newscast told him that an Eastern Airlines plane, New York to Miami, had crashed. The pilot was another Captain Clark, and the plane was Flight 23. If you want to know the extent of their control,
Simon told Joe, speaking this time, not writing a letter, they were driving to San Francisco after leaving Dillinger.
Take a dollar bill out of your wallet and look at it. Go ahead, do it now. I want to make a point.
Joe took out his wallet and looked for a single. A year later, in the city Simon called Czech Argo, in honor of the synchronous invasion in August 1968, the KCUF convention is taking its first luncheon break after Smiling Jim Socket Tum's opening speech.
Simon brushes against an usher, shouts,
"Hey, you damn faggot, keep your hands off my ass!"
And in the ensuing tumult, Joe has no trouble slipping the aum in the punch.
"Do I have to get a library card just to look at one book?"
Carmel asks the librarian in the main branch of the Las Vegas library, after Maldonado had failed to produce any lead to a communist agent.
"And the most puzzling acts of Washington's presidency."
Professor Percival Petz de Loop tells an American history class at Columbia back in 68.
"Was his refusal to aid Tom Paine when Paine was condemned to death in Paris."
Why puzzling, George Torn thinks in the back of the class. Washington was an establishment fink.
"First of all, look at the face on the front,"
Simon says.
"It isn't Washington at all. It's Weishaupt. Compare it with any of the early authentic pictures of Washington and you'll see what I mean. And look at that cryptic half-smile on his face."
The same smile Weishaupt wore when he finished the letter explaining to Paine why he couldn't help him. Sealed it with the great seal of the United States, whose meaning only he knew, and settling back in his chair, murmured to himself,
"Jacques de Molay, thou art again avenged."
"What do you mean I'm creating a disturbance? It was that faggot there with his big mitts on my ass."
"Well, I don't know which particular book, honey. Something that tells me how the communists work. You know, how a patriotic citizen can spot a commie spy ring if there's one in his neighborhood. That kind of thing,"
Carmel explained. A swarm of men in blue shirts and white plastic helmets rushes down the steps at 43rd Street and UN Plaza, past the inscription reading, "They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Neither shall they study war any more." Waving heavy wooden crosses and shouting angry battle cries, the helmeted men surge into the crowd like a wave hitting a sandcastle. George sees them coming and his heart skips a beat.
And when you turn the bill over, the first thing you see is the Illuminati pyramid. You'll notice it says 1776 on it, but our government was founded in 1788. Supposedly, the 1776 is there because that's when the Declaration of Independence was signed. The real reason is that 1776 is the year Weishaupt revived the Illuminati. And why do you suppose the pyramid has 72 segments in 13 layers?
Simon asks in 1969.
"Misunderstanding my eye, when a guy gropes my butt that way, I know exactly what he wants,"
Simon shouts in 1970. George nudges Peter Jackson.
"God's lightning,"
he says. The plastic hats gleam in the sunlight, more of them jostling down the stairs. A banner, red letters on a white background, unfurling above. "America, love it or we'll stomp you."
"Christ on roller skates,"
Peter says.
"Now watch the cops do a vanishing act."
Dillinger settles down cross-legged in a five-sided chamber under the UN meditating room. He curls into the lotus posture with an ease that would appear unusual in an American in his late 60s, were there anyone to witness it.
72 is the Kabbalistic number for the holy, unspeakable name of God used in all black magic, and 13 is the number in a coven,
Simon explains.
That's why.
The Volkswagen purrs towards San Francisco. Carmel comes down the steps of the Las Vegas Public Library, a copy of J. Edgar Hoover's Masters of Deceit under his arm, an anticipatory smirk on his face. And Simon is finally ejected from the Sheraton Chicago, shouting,
"Faggots! I think you're all a bunch of faggots!"
"And here's one of their jokes,"
Simon adds.
"Over the eagle's head, do you dig that Star of David? They put that one in, that one single six-pointed Jewish star made up of all the five-pointed stars, just so some right-wing cranks could find it and proclaim it as proof that the elders of Zion control the treasury and the Federal Reserve."
Overlooking the crowd in UN Plaza, Zev Hirsch, New York State commander of God's lightning, watches his thick-shouldered troops swinging their wooden crosses like tomahawks and drive back the lily-livered peaceniks. There is an obstacle. A blue line of policemen has formed between the men of God's lightning and their prey. Over the cops' shoulders, the peaceniks are screeching dirty words at their plastic-hatted enemies. Zeb's eyes scan the crowd. He catches the eye of a red-faced cop with gold braid on his cap. Zeb gives the police captain a questioning look. The captain winks. A minute later, the captain makes a small gesture with his left hand. Immediately, the line of police vanishes as if melted in the bright spring sun that beats down on the plaza. The battalion of God's lightning falls upon their anguished, outraged, and astonished victims. Zev Hirsch laughs. This is a lot more fun than the old days in the Jewish Defense League. All the servants are drunk, and the rain continues.